Good morning, everybody. May we proceed to case number one, please? First Defense Legal versus Richard A. Devine.
Thank you, Judge Coffey. May it please the court. District Court's injunction grants attorneys the right to interrupt an ongoing witness interview room, witness interview at a Chicago police facility.
Could I just ask, as we pursue this case, that we really focus on the essence of the holding, because I think the essence was not, as the city's brief keeps saying, anything about barging in. I think it's really more, if you imagined an attorney politely going up to the public desk that's in the front of a police department and saying, I'm here to see Smith. Does anything have to happen next? Is there some associational right of the attorney to have a message communicated back through whatever mechanisms would be considered appropriate within the police department, and I suppose when appropriate? Because that issue seems to me is a very important question, and it's an issue that does not depend, as the case now comes to us, on any rights that witnesses may have.
We agree, Judge Wood, but there's no question the injunction grants the right to interrupt. Somebody comes into that witness room under the injunction. It's at page A40 of our appendix. Either the attorney gets led back immediately to the interview room and interrupts the interview, or a police officer has to go back and take the witness out of the interview room and bring the witness to the attorney. Either way, for us to comply with the injunction, we are required to interrupt the interview. And we quite agree. The question that presents is there some associational right,
right, yeah,
that requires us to interrupt the interview? Now, the district court thought...
Counsel, why don't you proceed with your argument?
Right, that's what I think he's doing, yeah.
Go ahead.
The district court...
So you have time to get it in.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But I do appreciate your answering my question.
The district court thought that the First Amendment, and in particular its prohibition on viewpoint discrimination, supported this injunction. That was error. This morning I will explain why the First Amendment's prohibition on viewpoint discrimination is simply inapplicable and certainly does not give an attorney a right to meet with a witness undergoing an interview in order to have the opportunity to talk him out of cooperating with the police. Our submission this morning rests on a single premise. The manner in which the police go about trying to obtain cooperation from witnesses simply is not regulated by the First Amendment. We say that because soliciting cooperation involves the government as speaker. Police officers, of course, urge witnesses to cooperate with their investigation, but as all the government speech cases say, when the government is acting as speaker, as advocate, or in this case, as investigator, it is not bound by the requirement of viewpoint neutrality.
I thought that the issue, and maybe you can clarify the extent to which you think this is a fact question from the district court or not, was that other people, whether it's lawyers coming in, have the opportunity to get their message heard if that message is to encourage cooperation, but they don't have that opportunity if the message, as I think we can assume it often will be to say, stop cooperating.
Well, the district court thought that amounted to viewpoint discrimination. Some people are let in under some circumstances and others are not.
But is there an underlying finding of fact that you're also attacking here?
Well, we are attacking three findings of fact. There are three separate findings of fact we claim are clearly erroneous. Putting all that aside, accepting for the moment every single finding of fact, we say first, even if we engage in selective admission, we only admit the people that we think will facilitate the investigation, because the First Amendment's requirement of viewpoint neutrality is inapplicable here, that fact has no legal significance. We go on to say, again, assuming all the findings of fact are adequately supported, in any event, there is no viewpoint discrimination in the policy here because the policy bars all outsiders, even community groups, who advocate cooperation with the police. They aren't let back either. So for both those reasons, even putting aside our challenges to the findings of fact, we said that there is no impermissible viewpoint discrimination here.
So you're satisfied that there's no finding of fact that actually says your policy is anything but what Chief Klein described it to be? If the witness asks for his mother or for a lawyer or from whomever, if it stems from the witness,
that,
the police work
that
with
is correct.
It.
There is no finding of fact that says we let back groups who urge people to cooperate with the police. Now, we also say that the district court's reading of Chief Klein's testimony is deeply and offensively tortured, and we attack that as clearly erroneous. But even putting that aside, we see no applicability of viewpoint discrimination principles in this context, and in any event, we simply don't let back anyone. When the government acts as regulator, we quite agree, it is bound by the requirement of viewpoint neutrality, particularly in a forum for discussion or debate, but witness interview rooms are not forum. And putting aside the viewpoint neutrality principle, there is no basis to brand the police practice here as illegitimate or unreasonable. This is the precise practice that the Supreme Court sanctioned under the Fifth and Sixth Amendments in Moran. Why? The court tells us. Because if you let the attorneys back, they will tell the clients to stop talking, to stop cooperating with the police. And in Moran, the court said the government has an entirely legitimate interest in preventing that impediment to its investigations.
But you know, there is. I mean, the court did say that in Moran. But
counsel, do you realize you're into your rebuttal?
And I will be thrilled if I can get back to my seat as soon as possible.
If you like.
But I'm happy to answer Judge Wood's question.
Think about this, though. I think the concern is that the police like witnesses to be naive and uninformed, since you've said that you do protect those. But that may be a witness right, not an attorney right. I just throw that out.
Putting aside the rights of witnesses, because, of course, the plaintiffs themselves abandoned their claims
right.
on behalf of witnesses, the Supreme Court said it's striking a balance. Witnesses are not entitled to every kind of information that might usefully inform their decision whether to assert their Fifth Amendment rights. We do not see why exercising the leeway that the court granted the police in Moran is somehow illegitimate or unreasonable, and I will, with the court's permission, reserve the balance of my time.
All right.
Thank you, Judge Goff.
I'm sorry. I'll give you extra time when you're through, if you have to have it.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Castiglione, and I represent State's Attorney Richard Devine in this matter. Your Honors, we join the city's First Amendment arguments and ask only to, we only wish to make three additional points. First,
what are you joining? Because he didn't get them all out.
That's true. Well, we're joining the arguments made in his briefs as we did. We in our briefs chose to emphasize some additional points. Your Honor, first, we think that FDLA attorneys do not have a real attorney-client relationship with the witnesses they purport to represent. The record below shows that FDLA attorneys appear at Chicago police stations, ask to speak with clients in custody, and then after a brief conference with them, ask to speak with witnesses who are voluntarily speaking with the police. By engaging in this practice, the FDLA does not provide legitimate representation. In fact, often is in its essence representing both sides, and in fact does nothing more than muzzle the investigation of homicides and other serious crimes. Second, the district court's order unwittingly lays the groundwork for witness intimidation. As Chief Philip Klein testified below, a voluntarily cooperating witness often becomes worried when an unsolicited attorney appears and asks to see that witness, out of a fear that a gang has discovered that the witness is cooperating with the police. And in such a circumstance, a witness is concerned that they've been revealed, in a sense. So witness intimidation, we believe, puts witnesses in danger and, again, poses a serious obstacle to lawful investigations. And the third point we wish to make, Your Honor, is that the federalism concerns raised in this court's opinion in Palmer v. City of Chicago apply with full force here. Witness statements become an issue when they're introduced as evidence at a state court criminal trial. Plaintiffs asked the district court, and in fact this court, to really oversee motions to suppress and objections to evidence that properly belong in a state court felony trial. Your Honor, I see my time has expired. I reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
You have more time yet.
Oh, well.
That is no rule.
I went faster than I thought. I make one last point then, Your Honor. To conclude, this record is completely bereft of any evidence of any misconduct or any wrongdoing by the state's attorney. All that really was submitted was evidence that an assistant state's attorney, the supervisor of the felony review division, recited to one of the plaintiffs, Ms. Vukovic, and to a Chicago police sergeant, correctly recited the holding of an Illinois state court case, People versus DeSantis. That, we believe, is no basis for a permanent injunction against the state's attorney.
Thank you.
Thank
you,
Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Jacob Lewis. I'm an attorney with the Department of Justice representing the United States as an amicus in this case. Your Honor, this case would, yeah, the district court's theory, First Amendment theory, if accepted, would open up a Pandora's box of First Amendment claims in a host of contexts, out, even outside the law enforcement context, and certainly regarding people other than lawyers.
Including newspaper reporters.
Newspaper reporters, in fact.
Television reporters. I'm a friend of this witness.
They commonly, newspaper and television reporters commonly raise claims under the First Amendment, which, after all, talks directly about the press.
Mr. Lewis, I just wanted to get at that. I think it's a crucial point that it's your position, that of the United States, that there is no principled way to distinguish lawyers from all of these other potential.
Not so far as the First Amendment is concerned. And this case is only, from beginning to end, a First Amendment case. The First Amendment doesn't speak to the criminal process. The Fifth and Sixth Amendments do, and when the court was confronted with this exact kind of situation in Moran, admittedly in a case where the claims were raised under the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, it rejected any obligation of the police to inform.
Right. What about those legal services against Velazquez case? That was a First Amendment case, although granted from the funding area, but it did seem to treat the legal profession differently from, for instance, the medical profession.
Well, because, but in legal service in Velazquez, it talked about distorting the function of the lawyer in that case. That was the funding restriction was
right.
Questioned because it distorted the function of the lawyer. Moran tells you there's no distortion here in the, of the criminal process in this case by rejecting that same claim. There's no claim that, that somehow the criminal process under Fifth and Sixth Amendment law has been distorted. The police have a very important job to do. I mean, there are associational rights that lawyers have with their clients. They can talk, and nothing prevents them from talking to their clients, but not at any time and any place. Forum analysis gives the public access to government property under certain circumstances, but not everything is a forum, and a police witness interview is certainly not a forum. The government is entitled to facilitate the investigation of crime. That's a very important job they have, and the Constitution doesn't make that job impossible. That the fact is, the district court created a First Amendment theory out of whole cloth which admits of no limits and can be implied in any number of circumstances where people want to communicate with other people. The lawyer in Moran had an equally strong, in fact, probably a stronger claim to talk to his client, and the Supreme Court would have none of it. So the district court's First Amendment theory should be rejected and the judgment reversed. I thank the court.
Do you have anything else to add?
No, that's all I wanted to say. If the court has no further questions, I'm happy to sit down.
Thank you.
May it please the court. This case is about whether law enforcement officials can prevent a lawyer from communicating with his client, a voluntarily cooperating free citizen, because law enforcement prefers that the citizen be kept in the dark about his legal rights and responsibilities.
Perhaps you could begin where we just left off with Mr. Lewis and explain why it is that lawyers have this particularly protected associational right under the First Amendment as opposed to the press, which also certainly has special status, as opposed to family members, as opposed to anyone else, or is it the essence of your argument that the witness ought to similarly be informed if one of those individuals is present and wishes to speak with him?
What's clear in the record of this case, the city and the state's attorney had an opportunity below to suggest the possibility that there was a host of individuals standing outside the police station, press, relatives, and the like, who wanted to get in to see witnesses. They didn't. As far as this record reflects, and as far as I know, the only people who have been systematically excluded from seeing witnesses in police stations are FDLA lawyers.
But
they're not systematically excluded. What right do you have to see witnesses who haven't asked for you?
The witness is
who haven't asked for it. Just answer what I asked you.
A First Amendment associational right based upon a constellation of circumstances, among them the fact that we are lawyers. In addition to that, the fact that we...
I don't see how the First Amendment can give greater rights to lawyers than to other people.
Where is that?
I don't suggest in this case that the First Amendment rights of lawyers qua lawyers are elevated above everyone else. But this constellation...
You have to answer the question that if this injunction is correct, anyone can get equal access. A reporter can get access. A professor who wants to do a survey of witnesses or observe how police are doing things can get access. Maybe those things would be good, but I don't think one can deny that that's the logical implication of the position.
I think one can in this sense. We're lawyers. We're lawyers as to...
We're lawyers.
We're all lawyers.
Nowhere. It's kind of, you know, you judges are lawyers. Give us some special privileges. That ain't going to happen.
We have a message that is time sensitive, that has particular urgency to the people who are in custody.
All right. Message time sensitive, particular urgency. I now want to give you a woman in a hospital about to have an abortion. Somebody from a pro-life group wants access to that woman to persuade her not to have the abortion. First Amendment right of access?
There may or may not be.
A message of particular urgency and time sensitivity. Does the hospital have to let in the anti-abortion activist?
A decision in FDLA's favor in this case would not suggest...
I'm not asking you about this case. I'm asking you a hypothetical, Mr. Bowman. What happens in that hypothetical?
Well, in that hypothetical, one would need to ask a series of questions about the totality of the circumstances. One would need to ask, for example, whether that...
The hospital lets in only those people who are supportive of the woman's choice. It excludes those people who would disturb her or who would disturb the physicians. And it does that systematically because it thinks its job as a hospital is facilitated by keeping out those people who want to oppose the medical procedure.
I would suggest to you, Judge Easterbrook, that it's her call. She has, if the hospital has reason to believe...
It can't be her call. This is a First Amendment case, and the First Amendment rights at issue are the rights of the person who wants to come and speak.
But
we know that from Moran that the person in the witness room or in the hospital doesn't have to be notified. That person has no such rights. We're now dealing with a claim that the speaker has rights even if the person inside doesn't want to, right?
And well, so even on. If we don't know, I mean, because I think the notification issue is critical to your case. I think the essence of your case is how can the witness or the woman in the hospital or anybody else know whether they want to talk to the person or not if they don't even know they're there. Now, this injunction goes far beyond that, but that's a preliminary step one could think about. But Moran is something you might want to address for a minute.
Well, Moran does not foreclose, the rights of the witnesses are not before us in this case, but Moran does not foreclose the First Amendment issue as applied to the witness in two senses. First of all, Moran had to do with individuals who are formally enmeshed in the criminal justice system, who are in custody, whose associational rights, therefore, are curtailed. Those individuals cannot leave. They have very limited expectations with respect to freedom of association. That's what being in custody is. These people are witnesses who have voluntarily gone to the police station, in theory, to facilitate a police investigation. These interviews could, in a different circumstance, take place in the witness's home. In the witness's home, no one would suggest that the government has the authority to cut the phone line during the pendency of the interview because the government does not want the witness to know who is on the phone and does not want the witness to hear any information that the person on the phone might be interested in providing with respect to this urgent issue as to whether there should be communication with the police or whether other interests countervail that.
But
no one would suggest...
I can't think of any cases, though, where an associational right. There are plenty of cases about rights to association and so on, but usually the association is something that two people create, and you don't want the government breaking it up. And here, as Mr. Rosenthal said, there does, it may not sound like a lot, but there does have to be an affirmative step by the police. They've got to go back and either get the witness and bring that individual back out. They've got to, in a sense, create the association. And I'm not sure where we find authority for that affirmative duty on the part of the government.
Because of the unique...
What case law do you have supporting that? And can you tell me any other city in the United States that has the procedure that you're now arguing to us?
I am
there
not...
There isn't one, is there?
I am not personally...
There isn't one, is there?
May
have
I?
You done any research on it? I'm sure you have, because I have, and I can't find one. Not one in these United States.
I am not personally aware, Your Honor, of any other police department that takes free citizens and
or law
holds
enforcement
them in
agents.
Isolation from their counsel under the circumstances that the record reflects
isolation
occurs
from their counsel.
Here.
You have no. You said yourself they voluntarily came into the building.
As
cooperate.
As a legal matter, their status is as voluntary cooperators. As a practical matter, as the findings of the district court below reflect, the circumstances may be quite different. But what we have to do here, it seems to me, is to address the First Amendment issue from the supposition that these are free individuals with associational expectations.
And came in there voluntarily.
And came in there voluntarily, but
and
they
are voluntarily talking to the law enforcement agencies.
They could have said, I will talk with law enforcement, but in my home. And in that circumstance, no one would suggest that law enforcement could prevent an association between that person and a lawyer who has an expectation of talking with someone who, to whom he has undertaken professional responsibilities. These lawyers are volunteer pro bono.
You have no professional responsibility to any witness unless they have retained you, do you? Do
Judge,
you? Just Judge, answer that, yes or no. You have a responsibility to any witness unless they have retained you.
You do not.
Okay.
However, Illinois law contains the expectation with respect to a person in a police station that when a family member has undertaken to call and request a lawyer to assist the family member in the police station, that the attorney
is that
responsibility
in this record?
Yes, it is.
That
and
a family member called you and asked you to go there.
Yes, sir. That
what
is
case? What's that name, please? In this record?
The case of People versus Smith.
And no, the case that you're talking about. That
that's how
a family member called you and asked you to go in there. That's recited in this record in the lower court.
That's how FDLA gets its clients. It has.
But that's what you just argued.
Right.
You said a family member calls and I have asked us to.
Correct.
Okay. How much time do you need to finish your argument? Because we have asked you questions.
Well, I...
Your organized argument that you had.
I would...
I'll give you 3 minutes.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Judge Coffey.
All right.
I want to talk about the Moran issue. There are two... I wanted to suggest that there are two fundamental differences between Moran and this situation. The second that I didn't get an opportunity to mention is this. In Moran, by virtue of the custodial status, the individual has received a formal Miranda warning advising him regarding his right to counsel. And the Moran decision says that a person doesn't need a continuing flow of information to calibrate his situation once that warning has been issued. The finding below in this case was that these witnesses at the design and direction of the government are in ignorance concerning their legal rights and responsibilities, specifically their freedom to leave and their ability to terminate the interview. So that's a very profound distinction between this situation and Moran, in addition to the custodial issue that I mentioned initially.
So why doesn't that boil down, though, to an argument on your part that there should be something equivalent, not perhaps directly equivalent to a Miranda warning, but at least when a lawyer shows up, there's some right to be informed? And if that is your argument, it would be a new right.
All that this injunction, and that's the other point I wanted to make, the essence of this injunction and its scope and its particulars reflect the what was viewed by the district court as the lack of bona fides on the part of the police. But the essence of this injunction is merely that the most minimal message be delivered, that the lawyer is there. Somebody's there. The phone has just rung. It's your lawyer. Do you want to talk to him? And if the answer is no, that's the end of the discussion.
But the district court also wanted that information to be conveyed in the presence of the lawyer. And as the amicus brief from the police chiefs argues, that might be prejudicial to the witness's best interest.
It's hard for me to understand the arguments that are made in the amicus briefs and in the city's briefs and the state's attorney's briefs on the assumption that lawyers might be acting in bad faith as tools of criminal enterprises and
but
the
I don't
like.
Think you guys would be, but I mean, there are a lot of lawyers out there in the world, and some of them might be less reputable.
Well, I think that in terms of assessing this situation, the assumption has got to be that lawyers will behave ethically and responsibly in the interests of the people they have been called to represent. That has to be the assumption. And
why should judges assume things that they know to be contrary to fact? We know that some lawyers are agents of criminal syndicates. Some lawyers get indicted and convicted of that very thing.
There is no suggestion.
So why should we ignore that?
There is no suggestion in this record that these lawyers.
No, but this First Amendment right is not limited to first defense. It is not limited to these lawyers. If there is a First Amendment right, it's a First Amendment right of either everybody or all lawyers. Now, your answer to Judge Wood's question was, we have to assume that all lawyers are honest and above board and so on.
And that's a false assumption.
And that's my question. Why should we assume something contrary to fact?
I don't think
you're speechless.
That a court
I don't
of
believe
I'm
you.
Yes, I am speechless.
I don't in believe the, you. I would be too.
Doing my best.
I
see my time has expired. If I could just
we'll
just
give you a chance.
Just get one final sentence out. Let me try this. I think that the high interest of the Constitution of the United States, which is after all what's at stake here, needs to be interpreted on the assumption that lawyers who have been called to represent a witness will discharge that duty honorably.
I just don't
honorably.
Think we can assume that. You could say, and maybe it's true, that that's a risk that we just have to accept, that there will be some lawyers who will in fact be serving the interests of a criminal enterprise, and some witnesses will be terrorized, and we will have to accept that. And maybe that's right. But that seems to me a better way of going about it than putting on blinders.
Well, counsel, I'll give you some advice. Your argument should be addressed to the legislatures.
Judge Coffey is speaking, of course.
What?
I said Judge Coffey is speaking for himself.
I am.
My time has expired.
Do you need it? Because you have been interrupted a lot. Is there anything else that you want to add? I want to give you a full opportunity.
I appreciate the court's attention, and if there are no further questions from the bench, I would return.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Thank you. All right. Thank you, counsel.
Good
Let me begin by discussing Moran and the rights of witnesses. Mr. Bowman points out that these witnesses, in this case, because they're not in custody, haven't been given Miranda. Of course, that's right. The Supreme Court has expressly held that the extraordinary protections of Miranda are inapplicable when there is no custodial interrogation. Even probationers are not entitled to Miranda under Minnesota versus Murphy. Isn't it extraordinary that Mr. Bowman thinks the First Amendment somehow undoes the whole of the Supreme Court's Miranda jurisprudence and says a separate kind of warning has to be given?
But I think that's an overstatement. All he's saying is that in the subset of cases where a lawyer shows up, there is a small right to be told, someone's here for you. That's not the same as saying every witness has to be told, if you wish to have a lawyer, one will be furnished to you, et cetera, et cetera.
That's correct, Judge Wood. And what he is saying in precisely is the Escobedo subset of cases where a lawyer shows up, you have to get a warning. In Moran, the Supreme Court expressly rejected that view, and it would be extraordinary to say the First Amendment undoes a rule that says for the entire set of people who are not in custody.
Well, do you think the Supreme Court draws any distinction between people who are in custody and people who are not?
It does. The Supreme Court has consistently held people in custody have fewer rights than people who are in custody.
Or that different rights. Remember the articles in the paper about, there's a big flap about what great medical care prisoners were getting in California, and it was much better than the medical care that we ordinary citizens get because they were lucky enough to be in custody. And naturally, there are plenty of answers for that. But sometimes custody imposes extra responsibilities, sometimes fewer.
Well, and that leads me to the Hutchins case because...
The what case?
The Hutchins case we discussed in our brief, because even the press, which has explicit rights under the First Amendment, it doesn't have a right of access to people otherwise inaccessible to it. Wouldn't it be extraordinary to hold that attorneys have greater rights than the press? Now, that leads to Mr. Bowman's assurance, because even he's not really willing to say that attorneys have greater rights than the press under
the
First.
But the press has no fiduciary responsibility toward the client, whereas the attorney does.
The press would say it has a fiduciary obligation toward the public.
Well, but that's not the same as the client.
Self-serving statements don't make things true.
Well, that's correct, but that brings me back to Moran, because it turns out attorneys don't have a fiduciary obligation to get themselves into the interview room. Moran holds it is not one of the entitlements of a lawyer to get himself back into the interview room when the client hasn't asked for it, and that's why we quite agree with Mr. Lewis in the United States, that whatever the entitlements of attorneys are under the First Amendment or anything else, we know after Moran they don't include getting back into the witness room. For that reason, this is precisely the kind of legitimate investigative tactic blessed in Moran, and we can find no doctrinal basis, not in viewpoint discrimination or anything else, for holding that the First Amendment regulates the manner in which the police investigate. We respectfully request that the injunction be vacated.
Counsel, do you need any extra time now, as I gave other?
I do not, Your Honor, but thank you, Judge Carr.
You're sure, all right. Counsel.
Your Honor, I have three brief points in rebuttal. First of all, the record below does not show that family members calling to retain the FDLA. That's part of the problem here. Second, there was some, Mr. Bowman had some discussed at length about comparing interviewing a witness in a home as opposed to the police station. I point out that a voluntary witness cannot view a mugshot or a lineup in a home, but cannot perhaps do so in a police station. And reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions that apply would seem to me ought to apply. I agree with the first city if the
if
first time it doesn't.
If you talk any faster, only the angels can hear you.
Your Honor, I'm trying to jam a lot in. I apologize for that. I don't think the first time applies at all, but in any event.
You don't have to go to the Federal Express School of Advocacy.
Just take your time.
I'll make one last point. I agree there's no special right of association for attorneys. And, in fact, not only could a family member, but someone posing as a family member or someone not a family member at all could show up. And I think that really does open the Pandora's box, as the United States argued, to wreaking havoc with vital investigations that are time-sensitive and that need to proceed expeditiously. So with that, like the city, we would ask that the permanent injunction be vacated.
Do you need any extra time?
I think I'm... No, fine. Thank you.
Counsel, do you have anything else to say? Do you need any more time? Thank you all for your arguments, and we will proceed.